I'm Roger Altman, and I'd like to welcome you to today's Hamilton Project Forum on Energy and Energy Policy. I'm quite pleased that we've taken on this complex topic because we all know that the United States has had great difficulty coming to grips with energy policy. It would not be far-fetched, I don't think, to say that since the first oil embargo in 1973, we have not succeeded in forging a cogent and effective policy, despite countless promises from leaders on both sides of the aisle, and many in the private sector. And over those 38 years, the economic and political challenge of energy has become much more acute. As developing countries advance and world population rises, the demand for fossil fuels has grown dramatically. The direct and indirect costs of those fuels have risen sharply. The negative impacts on our climate have become indisputable, and the search for alternatives to fossil fuels has accelerated. Yet we have not made much progress towards changing the picture, nor is the outlook for changing the picture, at least today, a particularly encouraging one. This country, and for that matter the world's dependence on oil, gas, and coal, is not on track to change over the foreseeable future. Just look at any of the good quality, independent forecasts of energy consumption and the composition of that consumption, and you'll see what I mean, including that the prospects, unfortunately, for, quote, new nuclear, unquote, as it's called, have just been set back considerably by the tragedy in Japan. I know that many people think that all of the talk and all of the efforts towards renewables are changing our fundamental dependence, and those are certainly worthwhile efforts, but they haven't changed the outlook to any meaningful degree, at least yet. And that gets to one of the four Hamilton themes for discussion today, namely that the real costs of fossil fuels, including social costs, are not visible to consumers and to society, and as a result, consumption is skewed toward forms of energy which seem relatively cheap to consumers but actually aren't, and that we need the full costs, direct and indirect, to be reflected in the price of energy products to consumers. That's one of the key themes for today. We're also going to discuss the importance of R&D and the right role for government in that function. We're going to discuss a more efficient approach to environmental regulation, and we're going to discuss the necessity of addressing climate change on a global basis. Let me just say a final word about the actual format. We're going to start with a panel moderated by our director, the Hamilton Project's director, Michael Greenstone. And let me just say, Michael, who is a professor of environmental economics at MIT, has done a lot of very important work on this subject, and he's doing a brilliant job as the Hamilton Project's director, but he's extraordinarily qualified to lead this forum today. And the first panel will center around four papers being released today. You should all have them, and I especially suggest that you take a look at the framing paper, which Michael and Adam Looney put together. It's the first paper in the deck you have, focusing on strategies to give all energy sources equal footing in the marketplace. and expand our opportunities to use lower cost and cleaner alternatives. After a short break, we'll have a second panel. Bob Rubin will moderate that one. I'll let Michael describe the actual panelists and the formats, but I think you're going to find both of these panels to be really provocative and really stimulating. And then our keynote speaker, Senator Maria Cantwell, is going to talk about, among other things, the congressional climate, pardon the pun, for energy policy. So I think it's going to be an exciting day. I'm really glad we're taking this topic on. I'm going to turn this over to Michael. Thank you.
Thank you, Roger, and thanks to everyone for coming here today. I thought I would begin by introducing our distinguished panel. We have the good fortune of being able to call all of them friends, some better friends than others. And I will start with John Deutsch, who is an institute professor at MIT. All of our panel members have at one point been in academia and also in government. John has had countless roles in government, ranging from the director of the CIA to high-ranking positions in the Department of Energy and the Department of Defense. And we're very fortunate to have him here today. To my right, we have Joe Aldi, who's currently on the faculty at the Kennedy School at Harvard. He's also serves as special assistant to the president in the first couple of years of the Obama administration, focusing on energy and climate change. Joe is well qualified to talk about both the economics and the politics of these issues. And then finally, we have Ted Gehr, who's the co-head of economic studies at Brookings. He formerly taught at Georgetown, and I believe served in the Council of Economic Advisors and in the Treasury as a Deputy Assistant Secretary for Economics. So with that introduction of this distinguished group, I thought I would spend just a couple minutes talking about the strategy paper that Adam Looney and I put together. And it really has, if you get, you know, it goes on and on for page after page, but there's really only 2 points. Oops, gave it away. So the first is extraordinarily obvious, and it's that energy consumption is vital to our well-being. It powers our factories and computers, it fuels our cars, and keeps us cool on, you know, hot summer days in Washington, D.C. And in fact, innovations in energy production have really been at the center of a lot of the economic progress that this country has made. Transforming itself from an agricultural-based economy to a manufacturing-based one to a service sector one. And through those transformations, there's been incredible advances in well-being. I think life expectancy in the last century has gone up, has doubled in the United States, and I think a lot of that is due to increased energy consumption. This reliance on and a central role of energy consumption is not limited to the United States. As a lot of countries are now entering rates of economic growth that I think are practically unprecedented. And I just pulled these statistics last night. They're staggering. In 1990, China's GDP per capita was $350 per person. Today, it's $7,500. That's 20 years later. In India's case, their per capita income was $870 in 1990. Today, it's almost $3,400. And a lot of that growth is fueled by energy consumption. And as Roger highlighted, energy consumption is not going to go away, and it's really in a central part of increasing living standards and well-being around the world. And in fact, we put together or stole this graph on projections of world energy consumption. And you know, in the next 25 years, energy consumption is projected to increase by about 40%. So that's the first point. As I said, that's the especially obvious one. There's a second point, which I think is well understood, but maybe not quantified in quite the way that at least we were used to trying to quantify things. And so that's what we really tried to do with the second part of this. And that is really, you know, is this energy consumption and increasing energy consumption a problem? And, you know, the short answer, it's not a problem. Except for one thing, the criteria we use to choose the energy sources are largely, not completely, but largely made up of the prices, or determined by the prices we pay at the pump and in the prices we face on our utility bills each month. But, however, as much as we wish it were not the case, there are other costs. And those other costs come are not as obvious as they are at the pump or in the utility bill, but they come in three basic varieties. The first is there's a threat to our national security related to our consumption of petroleum, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. There are our energy sources compromise our health and well-being. And then the third is our energy choices lead to climate change. And I'll talk about each of these in turn now. So we at Hamilton Project, we love to have a great graph to capture our points. And when it comes to national security, we were not quite able to do that. So I'll just state the obvious. Oil plays a hugely important role in our economy. It powers most of our transportation sector. And the issue with that is that the world's reserves are largely concentrated in regions of the world that may not always have the United States' best interests at heart. And I think it's safe to say, you know, finding the exact causal link between oil and this or that foreign policy action is difficult, but I think it's safe to say that there's no doubt that our reliance on oil has constrained our foreign policy objectives. The second form of an indirect cost that is related to our form of energy consumption comes from the form of conventional air pollution. This is sulfur dioxide, total suspended particulates, carbon monoxide, ozone. And here on this map, what we've plotted the counties in the United States that have air pollution readings that exceed the federal standards. And there's federal standards for five different pollutants, and the counties are colored by how many different pollutants they exceed the standard for. So black is the worst, and yellow only exceeds for one of the pollutants. And the gray areas are all below the federal standards. And the point to make here is there's about 400 counties in the United States that account for probably two-thirds of the population where the level of air quality exceeds what the EPA has judged to be safe. And in fact, in some of my own research, I've shown that the levels of air pollution that we breathe lead to a few extra thousand infant deaths each year. The EPA estimates that air pollution contributes to 1 in 20 deaths annually. And in a really pioneering work, the National Academies of Science established that the costs of air pollution, setting aside carbon, are to the economy, if you tallied it all up, all the health costs and the lost days of work and children not being able to attend school, are about $120 billion per year. So again, that's a cost that we pay. It's not a cost we pay when we fill up the tank, but it is a real cost. The third cost that we pay from the form of our energy choices is in the form of climate change. And the burning of fossil fuels leads to the accumulation of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And there's now very strong evidence that that is leading to higher temperatures, will lead to sea level rise, will lead to stronger storms. And all of those things will affect the well-being of people in the United States and people around the globe. And what I've done here is put together a figure that counts the number of days that the average person in the United States faces annually where the temperature falls in different ranges. And so, like, the modal day for a person in the United States, they have about 75 days a year where the temperature is between 60 and 70. So that's kind of a typical day. And in the gray, that's the gray lines or blue-green lines are the current distribution of temperature. And what I really want you to focus on is the very last part, which is the number of days where the temperature is greater than 90 degrees Fahrenheit. And to be clear, that's not the high temperature, that's the average of the high and the low. So to be above 90 is really a hot day, even by Washington, D.C. standards. And what you can see is that currently the average American faces about one day a year where the temperature is that high. And what the purple lines are trying to say is they come from a state-of-the-art climate model, and they indicate that by the end of the century, we're on a path where the average person will face more than 40 days a year in the United States where temperatures are greater than 90 degrees. So it's just a massive change in the way we would live. And what's troubling about that is that the bad things associated with temperature are not a day that went from 65 to 75. They're all concentrated at the extremes. And so it would lead in a kind of not a virtuous circle to more and more energy consumption for cooling. It would threaten mortality rates. And all of that is just in the United States. So the United States government recently came up with an estimate of what the damages are associated with an extra ton of carbon dioxide emissions to the atmosphere, and they put that at about $21 per ton. And so let's put that in some context. Currently, the United States emits about 6 billion tons per year. So we counted $120 billion a year in losses associated with regular air pollution, and now we get to add to that another $120 billion associated with the changing climate. So again, just to at the risk of overdoing this, these are costs that are real. These are not costs that we pay at the pump, but they alter our life in important ways. So what we set out to do was to try and find a way to quantify, pull this all together in some easy to see summary numbers. And so here what we put on this graph is the cost of producing, never mind setting aside these indirect costs that I've been talking about, the cost of producing a kilowatt hour of electricity from a variety of different energy sources. And what you can see, is, I'll just read across it here, is an existing coal plant produces electricity at about 3.2 cents per kilowatt hour. That's all the way on the left. A new natural gas plant produces at about 5.5 cents a kilowatt hour. Wind with backup costs about 9 cents a kilowatt hour. New nuclear, as Roger alluded to, costs about 10 cents a kilowatt hour. And new solar with a backup natural gas plant beside it would cost about 12 cents a kilowatt hour. So when you look at this, and that's basically how we make energy policy, coal looks like a fantastic deal. Like, who doesn't want to pay the cheapest amount for energy? And so what we tried to do then was say, well, what happens if we add in the health costs? And what happens if we add in the changing climate costs? And so our purple bars here are adding in the health costs. And it fundamentally starts to change the calculation. Whereas coal looked like the best deal in town, like can't burn enough of it, now it looks different. The air pollution costs, the health costs associated with using coal are actually greater than the private cost of producing. It's 3.4 cents a kilowatt hour. And then you can add in on top of that, in the light gray, we are working on our color schemes at the Hamilton Project. The climate damages associated with the greenhouse gas accumulation. And so for coal, you get to add another 2.2 cents a kilowatt hour, and you add a little bit for natural gas and a little bit for some of the others. And what fundamentally changes or happens is what looked like a great deal, which was the use of coal, no longer looks like such a great deal. And in fact, the true costs of coal exceed the private costs by about 170%, and other technologies now look much more competitive. And so the thesis of our paper is that we've created an energy playing field that is tilted towards energy sources that only appear cheap at the pump and in our utility bills. And our argument and suggestions or principles for policy going forward is that we don't have to have a tilted playing field. We could level the playing field and thereby let all energy sources compete on the same footing. And that would largely involve recognizing these social costs. I want to emphasize for those of you who are good at noticing that 3.2 is smaller than 8.8, this would not be for free. It would